Page and made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
Today should be another beautiful day. It was a great weekend, in my opinion, and temperature-wise, mostly sunny today. Highs 72 to 75 with light and variable wind. Mostly cloudy tonight, lows 48 to 52, and then tomorrow, good chance for showers, possible thunderstorms, high 69 to 72, winds from the southeast 5 to 10 gusting higher. Rain is likely Tuesday night and lows tomorrow night near 50. And Wednesday, that chance of rain continues, mostly cloudy with highs in the upper 60s. Remember, coming up at 9 o'clock, Heidi Holton, your host for Headwaters. Request line theme today is your favorite world music in honor of the World Cup. So text in your suggestions. Start thinking about that. Text us at 218-326-1234. It's time for the Up North Report.
For KAXE News, I'm Megan Buffington with the Up North Report. It's hardly a multitude, but a record number of women currently serve as U.S. governors, and a record number are also seeking the office in the November election. Minnesota is one of several states where a woman has never held the top job. Kelly Dittmar tracks how women are doing in the political arena as director of research for the Center for American Women in Politics. She says they still represent less than a third of the country's governors. And this year, six incumbents are term limited and the Iowa governor is retiring.
In order to keep the number at the record level that we have today, which is 14 women governors, we have to at least elect six new women governors in this cycle.
Minnesota is known for exceptionally high voter turnout and is more likely to choose a Democratic candidate. The state's primary is not until August 11th, but U.S. Democratic Senator Amy Klobuchar is currently favored to win the nomination. Four other states where a woman has never been put forward for the governor's office also are fielding candidates this year, including Georgia, Ohio, Tennessee, and Wisconsin. Not all political filing dates have passed, but the number of Democratic women running for governor has hit a new high of 43 compared to 41 in 2018. At the same time, the number of Republican women who filed is 29, 8 short of the 2022 record of 37. Of the current female governors, Dittmar notes 10 are Democrats and 4 are Republicans. She says those metrics suggest there's still a lot that can be done to encourage women to run for office.
Even in a year that looks good for women candidates running for governor, we're seeing women still be underrepresented in the pool, and we're seeing these partisan disparities that are persistent.
Live music and long-lost rural connections came to life in southern Minnesota Wednesday. A national tour featuring regional artists bills itself as a spark for community organizing that's hard to find in smaller towns. Henderson, an hour south of Minneapolis, was a stop on the Backroads Tour, led by the Coalition Rural Progress. The Minnesota Songwriter Sanctuary has a studio there that caters to regional songwriters at little or no cost. Director Ezra Crowley says they're helping with the show, and he reflects on the power of music to pull together people with different political beliefs.
They're upset about a lot of the same things. They want a lot of the same things out of life, and they're just speaking different language. And music unifies people because it's a language that we all speak.
As the nation celebrates America's 250th anniversary, organizers feel the tour is a more honest cultural expression of rural life, as opposed to stereotypes and political talking points. Amid population challenges, festival officials say rural areas lack spaces for folks to gather and share ideas. Regional artists like Duluth funk jam band Salty Dog and national acts like Joe Troop, who blends bluegrass with Latin American styles, performed. Matt Hildreth with Rural Progress says there's enough variation on each stop to show that rural areas are not all the same.
We're looking for artists that can capture the regional identity of an area and then also bring along artists that can share their regional identity from places like Appalachia, for example, to places like rural Minnesota.
Crowley says the festival also is a launch point for his nonprofit to share a mobile stage with other small towns across Minnesota for future events. He says giving them badly needed arts infrastructure is a nod to the state's creative and civic-minded spirit he feels has become overlooked. Thanks to Minnesota News Connection for these stories. MnDOT is beginning two Northland projects on Monday. The agency is replacing an aging box culvert on Highway 71 at Hay Creek, about 9 miles north of Park Rapids. The ATV trail adjacent to the bridge will also be improved. Motorists should expect a detour during construction, which is expected to end in mid-August. MnDOT will also be starting pavement preservation work on Highway 53 north of Cotton. Motorists should expect single-lane traffic in both directions through Thursday. On Wednesday, the same work will start on Highway 73 south of Cromwell, lasting through Friday. There will be single-lane traffic with flagging operations and a pilot car. Permanent pavement markings will be placed during the week of July 6th. That's it for the Up North Report. From the KAXE News Desk, I'm Megan Buffington, telling the stories of northern Minnesota through local news.
The Up North Report on KAXE is sponsored by Woodland Bank, dedicated to serving local businesses, families, and nonprofits in our area since 1920. You can find more information online at woodland.bank.
You can hear the latest edition of the Up North Report today at 5:30 during All Things Considered here on KAXE. Also check out our website for lots of local news stories and conversations, including last week's, we had two bright spots last week.
Okay.
So check that out, KAXE.org. I'm Jennifer Barr with Steve Noy. It's the Monday Morning Show.
We receive support from the Move It Real Estate Group, assisting clients with real estate purchases and sales for over 25 years, not only in Grand Rapids, but across northern Minnesota. Move to what moves you. More at moveitrealestate.com.
We also thank Lake Country Power, a Touchstone Energy cooperative serving more than 44,000 members in northern Minnesota. Lake Country Power, energy that powers our lives.
Today will be mostly sunny, high 72 to 75, light and variable wind, with tonight we're looking at mostly cloudy, lows 48 to 52. Chances of showers and possible thunderstorms tomorrow, high 69 to 72 with a southeast wind, 5 to 10 miles per hour with a little gust a little higher. Rain is likely tomorrow night with overnight lows near 50. Wednesday we'll be looking at more chance of rain, mostly cloudy, highs in the upper 60s.
We'll have events up north coming up at about 7:20, but right now it's more from Morning Edition from National Public Radio.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. The U.S. and Iran had a long first day of negotiations in Switzerland with the goal of permanently ending the war.
President Trump was not there, but was close to his phone and made bellicose remarks on social media that threatened to upend the talks just as they were starting. The two sides have agreed previously to a roadmap and have 60 days to resolve a host of issues.
For details, we're joined by NPR's Greg Myrie, who is in Tel Aviv. Greg, hello to you.
Hi, Michelle.
So they've given themselves 60 days. How did day one go?
Well, it was pretty rocky. Vice President J.D. Vance led the U.S. delegation in Switzerland and he sounded an upbeat note. But President Trump threatened in social media posts and in interviews to again attack Iran. At one point, the Iranian media said the country's delegation was walking out because of Trump's comments, though that didn't actually happen. The talks lasted into the early hours of Monday. The two countries mediating the talks, Pakistan and Qatar, put out a statement saying there was encouraging progress, and the U.S. and Iran have agreed to a roadmap. This includes a working group on the war in Lebanon, which will clearly be a key part of these talks. They also set up a line of communication to deal with the Strait of Hormuz, and lower-level working groups are now set to continue meetings all week.
Okay, I'm going to ask you about all these things. I'll take them one by one. First, what is happening with the war in Lebanon?
You know, yesterday was a good day. UN peacekeepers said they did not record shooting by either side Sunday, the first such day since the fighting erupted on March 2nd. It's now midday here today, and so far it remains quiet. But it's still very combustible. Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, said the first real test of this peace effort is the Lebanon war. There was very heavy fighting Friday and Saturday. Israeli troops remain miles inside southern Lebanon. The Israeli leader Benjamin Netanyahu says Israel will keep troops there for as long as it takes, he says, to protect northern Israel. Hezbollah is also defiant, saying the war will not be settled until Israeli troops leave Lebanon.
Okay, let's turn to the Strait of Hormuz. Is oil still flowing today?
Yeah, Michelle, it's a hard one. It's kind of unclear at the moment. Iran said over the weekend it was closing the strait because of the fighting in Lebanon, but that was before the fighting died down in the last day and a half. Now, U.S. Central Command says the strait remains open. Quote, Iran does not control the Strait of Hormuz. Traffic continues to flow. Now, according to groups monitoring shipping traffic, dozens of ships passed through the strait Saturday. This was one of the busiest days, maybe the busiest day since the waterway was closed nearly 4 months ago. But the traffic slowed down sharply on Sunday. We're keeping watch today, trying to see what's happening.
And of course, the big issue remains Iran's nuclear program. Was there any movement on that front?
So a U.S. diplomat who's not authorized to speak publicly said there were, quote, robust discussions on all elements of the nuclear deal. Now, the statement by the Pakistan and Qatar mediators mentioned the nuclear issue as one of several discussed, but gave no details. It seems the immediate focus is these urgent questions like the war in Lebanon and the Strait of Hormuz. The U.S. certainly expects to address Iran's nuclear program in depth and once a deal, but it may not be the top of the agenda right now.
Interesting, since that was the stated reason for starting all this. So that is NPR's Greg Myrie in Tel Aviv. Greg, thank you.
Sure thing, Michelle.
We've heard plenty of debate in the United States over the U.S. agreement with Iran. Vice President Vance has defended the agreement in many interviews. Some Republicans have cast it as a surrender, even if they originally supported the war. Some Democrats have said it's a terrible deal, yet still better than Trump's war. Now we'll sample opinions from Israel and Iran. We reached two Iranians, both of whom asked us not to use their full names out of fear of retribution. V is in his 30s and lives in Tehran.
I think a lot of people here are just relieved. Most people are just so fed up with this uncertainty for the past year that they just hope that the final agreement is reached and life gets back to normal.
While he welcomes an end to the fighting, he says many others are skeptical that it will last.
People on both sides of the spectrum still believe that this is a trap and the U.S. is going to buy some time and maybe find another excuse after the World Cup or after the midterm elections in the U.S. and start bombing Iran again.
So that's a voice from Tehran. Mehraz is in the northern city of Ghazvin. He is a writer in his 40s.
Majority of Iranian people expected the collapse of the regime. Right now, they are deeply disappointed.
Mehraz is pessimistic that life will improve for the Iranian people.
The United States has often followed a similar pattern with its adversaries. Sometimes after a change of administration, the same cycle tends to repeat itself. Negotiations, agreements, sanctions, threats of war, or even war.
Which is why, Mehraz says, he is indifferent to the peace talks.
It doesn't really matter to me whether an agreement is reached or not, because our opinions mean nothing to this brutal regime.
That's how some Iranians are feeling about peace talks between the U.S. and Iran. Now we have a voice from Israel, where we have reached Alon Pincus. He is a former Israeli diplomat who advised two former Israeli prime ministers and four foreign ministers. Ambassador, welcome.
Thank you. Good to be with you, Steve.
So I'm looking at numbers from this poll released by the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, and the top line is that 92% of Israelis believe that Iran won the war. I'm thinking about the old joke about the impossibility of getting any Israelis to agree about anything. 92% have the same opinion that you lost the war?
Yeah, but they each come, I would imagine, from a different angle, and they each have three angles to explain why they reached that unity or unison. But that's not the only interesting number. 72.5% of Israelis do not believe Netanyahu when he boasts about the achievements of the war, And 85%, roughly, I think it was 85, I recall from memory, you probably have the poll numbers ahead of, in front of you. Mm-hmm. 85% think that no significant gains have been made. And so 92 is not that far away.
92% feel that Israel yep. lost. Did people feel that way, though, I don't know, a month ago when the people felt that they'd won before the peace negotiations is what you're telling me.
Well, exactly. You just nailed it in terms of the timeline. When this war began and there was all this bravado about, you know, these monumental, heroic, glorious military achievements that both Israel and the U.S. Bragged about, Israelis were certain that this is going to be a decisive victory. And the weeks went by, and it was less of a decisive victory. On April 8th, President Trump announces a ceasefire that was then extended every 2-3 weeks. Mm-hmm. But then, news is leaked, and bits of information about a MOU, a Memorandum of Understanding, being formed. And all of a sudden, Israelis felt that Trump is trying to cut his losses, that Trump is unhappy with how the war has developed, that Trump feels that he was perhaps manipulated or misled or wronged by Mr. Netanyahu when he made all these assurances about the quick and decisive victory. Hmm. And they started questioning whether this war achieved anything, given the superiority that the U.S. and Israel had militarily. The fact that Iran attacked the Arab Gulf states, the fact that Iran shut down the Strait of Hormuz, even for people who are not geopoliticians or grand strategists, when they walk into the supermarket or sit in a cafe, they sensed that viscerally, they sensed it, that the war is not being as successful as it is branded. And at that point, they stopped believing what Trump and Netanyahu were saying, but more importantly, Steve, they began to understand, again, instinctively or intuitively, that Iran may emerge victorious.
Well, are there Israelis then among those 92% who are unhappy with the outcome because they wanted the war to continue?
Absolutely. Absolutely. By the way, there's a mirror image here of hardcore Trump supporters who can't reconcile why he went into a war in the Middle East, why he engaged in a war after promising not to engage in forever wars. And so they're blaming an outside agent. They're blaming Netanyahu for dragging him into the war. And then comes the mirror image. Netanyahu supporters were saying, how could this have happened with all this military superiority and dominance? So they're blaming Trump for not going all the way. And you see this, but both sides seem to agree, I mean, both on the Israeli side and the American side, that in terms of what's been set as the grand objectives, regime change, the missile program and the nuclear program being destroyed, et cetera, that the war has been a major debacle.
What are the political implications of this with the elections coming up in Israel in October or by October?
I think they will be huge because Prime Minister Netanyahu is carrying the burden of three major, colossal failures. The October 7, 2023 Hamas attack under his watch, the worst catastrophe in Israel's history. Then this impasse leading nowhere in Lebanon, and most pertinently for our conversation, a war in Iran that should have been prosecuted along different lines that Israelis have been told. So I think this, in a major way, adversely impacts his chances in an election.
Alon Pincus is a former Israeli diplomat. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Steve.
This is NPR News.
It is 7:19. Thanks for listening to the Monday Morning Show on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr with Steve Noy with you until 9 o'clock, and then it's Headwaters with Heidi Holton. Reminder, her request line theme for today is your favorite world music in honor of the World Cup. Text us at 218-326-1234.
Time for Events Up North, a closer look at some of the events happening across northern Minnesota. The Friends of the Brainerd Public Library continue their Brown Bag Author Series. Today at noon, Alan Eskins will talk about his most recent book, The Quiet Librarian. Feel free to bring your own lunch or enjoy the light refreshments provided.
And poet Jolene Brink will read from her new book today at 6 o'clock at the McCroskey Art Center in Grand Rapids. Brink grew up in Grand Rapids, and the reading will be followed by a conversation about writing and history and creativity with her former teacher, Frida Hall. And we'll be talking with Jolene and Frida coming up at 8:45 this morning.
Meet the Bemidji High School Marching Band on Tuesday, June 23rd. Enjoy a pulled pork dinner at Bemidji High School starting at 5:30, followed by a performance in the arena at 7.
And the 34th Annual Gallery Hop on Howard Street in downtown Hibbing is this Thursday from 2 to 7. Explore 15 galleries and businesses featuring local artists and live music.
Watermark Art Center in Bemidji hosts an outdoor artisan market on their south lawn on Saturday. You can from 9 to 1, you can shop art, flowers, locally made foods, and more with live indigenous flute music by Frankie Graves.
And the University of Minnesota's North Central Research and Outreach Center in Grand Rapids invites you to its annual Visitors Day this Saturday from 10 to 4. Explore 130 years of agricultural research and education through exhibits, demonstrations, and hands-on activities. That is free and open to all.
The Namath Arts Center in Park Rapids hosts an artist reception on Saturday from 4 to 6 for Rosemary Holiday Hall. Her exhibit is on display now through July 18th and explores the dynamic relationships between nature and the built environment.
And happening Saturday, it's the Beltrami Block Party in downtown Bemidji. That starts at 1 o'clock with free live music with Eric Koskinen and David Huckfeldt, Little Fevers, plus more, and we'll have... there'll be food and beverages on Beltrami Avenue. You can find more info at KAXE's Facebook page, and that event made possible by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.
The Mask and Rose Women's Theater in Puposki is celebrating 20 years on Saturday. Come for cake at 6 p.m. and stay for the Sister Song Celebration Concert at 6:30. Concert is outdoors, so bring your own seating, water, and bug spray. Pay what you are able to support future scholarships and concerts.
Events Up North is made possible by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota. If you have events to share with our listeners, send us an email, psa@kaxe.org. And you can find Events Up North at kaxe.org every week.
Boy, a busy day Saturday, for sure.
Lots happening yes. Saturday, yes. And that kind of is about our question of the week, small town celebrations. We want to hear about your favorite ones, if you have any fun stories from one, as summer is ramping up and the 4th of July will be here before we know it. So love to hear from you. Text in about your small town events, 218-326-1234.
We want to hear about them. We want to hear about those, especially I do, because I've only been here for about 4 years, so I'm not terribly familiar with stuff. All I know is the Tall Timber Days here in Grand Rapids. It's my annual tradition to get a blueberry lemonade in those big old cups that almost look like buckets.
Oh yeah.
And that is my treat for the year during the summer.
Yeah, lots coming up. I know July's very busy, Bemidji Water Carnival happening around the 4th of July.
Okay.
Tons going on. And you could do something every weekend for sure. You could make the rounds if you right. wanted to on these small town festivals.
Okay.
So yeah, love to hear from you. 218-326-1234. Right now, we are going to hear more about this week's pick of 76. Here's Malachi Coons.
Our next pick of 76 is Rye Cooter's fifth solo album, Chicken Skin Music. Sandwiched between a pair of Lead Belly covers are minstrel tunes done funky, an Appalachian traditional and Hawaiian slack guitar medley, and Norteño and Bolero versions of pop country songs. In particular, the Hawaiian and Tex-Mex influence is strong, with authentic Hawaiian guitar players Gabby Pahanui and Ada Isaacs, plus accordion legend Flaco Jimenez. Cooter's standing as one of the era's most sought-after session players gave him the freedom to pursue his eclectic and uncommon-for-the-time music tastes in his own albums. Chicken Skin Music paved the way for the more eclectic side of roots and Americana and showed that seemingly far-apart genres are always more connected than you think.
That's this week's pick of 76, and I'm going to play a song from that album now, Ry Cooder's Chicken Skin Music. This one's called I Got Mine.
Now we're down the big crap game, certainly was against my will. I lost every doggone nickel I had, but a greenback dollar bill. $40 bet laid on the floor, my buddy's point was 9. Well, the police, they come and they caught all of them, but I got shop is way across town, down on North Walker Street. Only place on a Saturday night, Gus gamblers cares to meet. Some comes in for a haircut, and others come for a scrap. When you see me, my buddies up there, man, we means to shoot some crap. Holland, 7-11. If you don't serve me, 11 dice, I'm a thunder. Now if I see the police, before he sees me, I'm gonna run. Got mine. Sure
That is I Got Mine by Rye Cooter from our pick of 76, Chicken Skin Music, that album is called, and we'll be hearing more of that throughout the week as we've been looking back at the music from 1976, the year of KAXC's founding, or first going on the air, I should 50, say.
50 years. There you go.
Yeah. All right. That is Steve Noy. I'm Jennifer Barr. It's the Monday Morning Show on KAXC.
Support comes from Watermark Art Center in downtown Bemidji with four galleries, art classes for adults and children, and a retail art gallery, Shop 505. The center is accessible and open to the public. More at watermarkartcenter.org.
And we thank the First State Bank of Big Fork with branches in Big Fork and Kellyer, offering tools for managing money on any mobile device. Hometown banking at its best since 1912, fsbbigfork.com, member FDIC.
We're looking for your ideas for small town events or festivals that you think everyone should experience. That's our question of the week. Because summer is ramping up, we want to hear about what you do for festivals here locally. You can text us at 218-326-1234.
It is time now for best wishes. We're going to do our best to wish our friends and neighbors happy birthday, happy anniversary, starting with yesterday, June 21st. Mike and Pam Peterson, happy 57th to you in Grand Rapids.
Laura Whitley and Pat Eliason in Duluth, happy anniversary.
Susan and Jim Lee, happy anniversary to you in McIntosh.
Emily and Patrick McFarland, happy 24th anniversary in Des Moines.
And Rick and Bobby Henderson, celebrating 51 years of marriage in Moorhead.
Dan Zorman, DJ Ironsides, is celebrating a birthday in Hines.
And Sol Jaeger, happy 15th to you yesterday in Duluth.
Ken Rumbaugh is celebrating 56 years. Happy birthday, Ken, from Portland.
And Suzanne Hinrichs, happy birthday to you yesterday in Brainerd.
Today, June 22nd, Tom and Jackie Whitty are celebrating 51 years, their anniversary in Mount Iron.
Lee and Susan Tollefson, happy 58th to you in St. Paul.
Carolyn Humpel, happy 50th birthday in Grand Rapids. Happy birthday.
And Don Statine, happy birthday to you in Brainerd.
Andrew Dotko, happy birthday in Gilbert.
And Doug Johnson, our king of green cheese. He's a garage sale ninja, turning 70 today in Bemidji. And we got a special song request for our king of green cheese. This is Leo Kottke. The song's called Jack Gets Up.
Every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed and you crawl out of bed and you crawl out of bed. Every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed and you look out the moon where the window is and the stars shine and the stars shine and the stars shine. Every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed. Way down below in the sun belt and the telephones and the telephones and the telephones and you look out the moon where the window is every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed. And some of us breathe in the brown ground where the worms clown, where the worms clown, where the worms clown. Way down below in the sun belt every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed. Every night when you lay down, you fall flat, you fall flat, you fall flat. Some of us breathe in the brown ground every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed. So we're all asleep in the same dream in the snort fort, in the snort fort, in the snort fort. And every night when you lay down, every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed. Santa Claus modified snow peas on the sunroofs, on the sunroofs, on the sunroofs. So we're all asleep in the same dream every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed. If you look in the mirror, it's your father's face, and a thin grin, and a thin grin, and a thin grin, and Santa Claus pulling up snow peas every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed. There's tears in the bank and a credit card in the backyard, in the backyard, in the backyard. If you look in the mirror, it's your father's face every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed. And once in a while, when the wind blows and the heart whines and the heart whines and the heart whines, there's tears in the bank and a credit card every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed. But there's lint in the pocket and a breath mint or a car key or a car key or a car key. Once in a while when the wind blows every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed. And your kid has a face like a walnut from the ice cream, from the ice cream, from the ice cream. But there's lint in the pocket and a breath mint. Every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed. Every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed. Every day in the morning when you get up and you crawl out of bed.
That is Leo Kottke. The song's called Jack Gets Up for our King of Green Cheese on his 70th birthday. If you have best wishes to share, you can always text in 218-326-1234. Love to hear from you and share those best wishes. We just heard from our volunteer, Jim Gallagher. He said, great music choices this morning. Love the weirdness of that Leo Kottke song. Good to hear from you, Jim. Thanks for that.
That kind of echoes my sentiment there as well. Oh, coming up at the 8 o'clock hour, Megan Buffington with our latest North Star student from WinEMAC. Will be a regular thing that we do with our we highlight a student, a high school student that is especially noteworthy. Yeah.
Yeah, doing great things.
Yep.
Yep, WinEMAC is located, that is the towns of Winger, Erskine, and McIntosh, which are, if you're headed west on Highway 2 past Bagley, Foston, it's that direction.
So. Okay, all right, yeah.
Brainerd Animal Hospital presents Pups in the Park Saturday, June 27th, 10 to 2 at Lum Park in Brainerd. You can see dog demos throughout the event, plus there is a pie-eating contest for both kids and dogs. A silent auction, crafts, food, and much more to raise funds for the Babinski Foundation Animal Shelter. I wonder, with the pie-eating contest for dogs, if they have a special kind of, you know, dog-appealing pie, or if they're just getting, like, you know, a blueberry pie.
Yeah, I know, because you can get, like, the pup cups when you go through the coffee shop drive-thrus. So, yeah, I don't know, is that a special kind of, like, whipped cream, or...
Well, like, maybe, like, a dog, just, like, dog food pie.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, well, that's true, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, kind of like,
you know, wet dog food and a little crust.
Yeah, there we go.
Sure, it would be very appealing to a dog.
Yeah. Weather today will be mostly sunny. High is 72 to 75. Light and variable wind. Tonight, mostly cloudy. Lows 48 to 52. And tomorrow, we have a chance of showers, possible thunderstorms. High 69 to 72. Southeast winds, 5 to 10 miles per hour. Gusting higher. Rain likely tomorrow night with overnight lows near 50. Wednesday, we've got a chance of rain, mostly cloudy, highs in the upper 60s.
Unfinished Freedom 250 Years On is a community festival on Sunday, June 28th at Miners Pavilion next to Yamar Arena in Grand Rapids. Enjoy live music and food trucks from 1 to 8 featuring Paul Metza, Sam Miltich and friends, Scarlett Woods, and many more. Bring your own chair to that event.
Fire in the Village presents Magical Fry Bread Drive-In, a mini mobile music fest featuring poetry and printmaking. Join them at Sam Paguita in Aiken on June 29th, Headwaters Music and Arts on June 30th, and at Old Central School in Grand Rapids on July 1st. Find tickets and full details at fireinthevillage.org.
And We Are Water Minnesota is a traveling exhibit that explores the interconnected role of water in recreation, culture, community, and agriculture. This exhibit is on display now through August 10th at Itasca State Park's Lakeside Museum.
The call is open for Watermark Art Center's biannual members show. Artists may submit up to 2 items now through August 8th. The exhibit will run through most of September and October in Bemidji. Find an application form and more at more information at watermarkartcenter.org.
Coming up before 8 o'clock, it's What We're Reading, our show all about books with our staff librarian, Tammy Bobrowski. Today, Tammy talks with debut author Meg Charlton. But right now, it is time for our daily dose of phenology, the rhythmic biological nature of events as they relate to climate. Here is John Latimer.
On today's date, June 22nd, in the year 2000, the red elderberry fruit are ripe. We have seen these plants from the beginning of the spring when they were the first or among the first to leaf out, and then among the first to flower, and then after their flowering, they began to set fruit. And now, here at the end of June, the fruits are by and large more red than green. And these berries are not edible. They are cathartic in every sense of the word. If you eat the red elderberry berry, you're going to find yourself in need of a place to go to the bathroom. Toilet paper will be required. It's a quick way to empty your bowels eating these fruits. And these are not to be confused with some of the other elderberries and currants, which are in that same group. This one, the red elderberry, it's strictly bird food. And if you want to encourage the birds to plant elderberry around your property, pull up a string nice and tight along your property line or wherever you want the elderberry to grow. And if there's an elderberry nearby and the birds are feeding on it, when they land on that string, they're going to leave behind some seeds and a little bit of nitrogen to help that seed get started. And you will have plenty of elderberries in a very short period of time.
That is our daily dose of phenology. You can tune in tomorrow morning at 7:20 for John Latimer's latest observations. I also love to hear what you've been seeing in nature. You can text in at 218-326-1234.
Our request line for Headwaters coming up at 9. Headwaters at 9, the request line at 10:30 is world music. We're looking for suggestions of world music. Heidi Holton will be your host, bringing you 2 hours of great music. And she's looking for world music to celebrate the World Cup that is happening right now.
Yeah, we're going to hear a song right now from Jalado Tropical, which is a blend of Jalado Negro and Reina Tropical. The song's called Toconado.
Pasaste y el amor no me pegó como antes.
That is new music from Gelato Tropical. That song's called The Condo. And it's the Monday Morning Show here on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, offering fiber optic fast internet speeds up to 10 gig and GigaZone Wi-Fi to support devices wirelessly. Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's local broadband cooperative. Right now it's time for What We're Reading, our show all about books, produced by our staff librarian Tammy Bobrowski. Today we'll hear from debut author Meg Charlton. Meg's new novel is called Voyagers. It's a story that explores memory and the enduring power of friendship at the end of the world. Meg talks about how her novel was inspired by her experience working with a documentary crew at Roswell, New Mexico, and how memory affects our interpretation of our experiences.
Decades ago, six-year-olds Alex and Anna vanished for 36 hours while on vacation in Palm Springs. They returned unharmed, but where they were and what happened to them was unexplainable, igniting the media and country in a firestorm of conspiracy theories. The event forged a bond between Alex and Anna, lasting through their adolescence until the never-ending spectacle of their disappearance tears them apart. Flash forward to today. A mysterious transmission, a signal, from the solar system is detected and growing stronger, prompting Alex to reunite with Anna. What is the signal, and does it have anything to do with their childhood disappearance? Joining me now to talk about this thrilling and original story is author Meg Charlton. Meg, friendship, family, reliability of memory, the possibility of extraterrestrial intelligence. How did all of these things become this story?
Thank you so much for that lovely summary of the book. You know, I first came up with kind of the very early seeds of this story back in 2015 when I was down in Roswell as part of a documentary film crew. And part of what inspired me was kind of hearing the stories of different experiencers and also seeing the kind of conflicting poles of skeptic and believer, and realizing that both sides can kind of cling to this very dogmatic vision of the world, this very rigid narrative about what did or didn't happen. And I was interested in kind of what the lived experience would be of someone who almost went on a conversion toward agnosticism, somebody who found a way to somewhere in between those poles and was able to kind of sit with the real you, the unidentified, in their own lives. And those questions about reliability and memory and friendship and family, you know, they all are obviously being grappled with for these characters at this very extraordinary level, given what they went through. But to me, they seemed very universal. You know, we all have these memories, especially from early childhood, that diverge with or conflict with those of the people that we love and the people who supposedly went through those experiences with us. You know, you can grow up in the same house and yet end up with completely different interpretations of what that experience was like. And so I think I was really interested to explore that incredibly kind of common and basic reality of the unreliability of all of our memories through the experience of the experiencers, through these people who are really called to account for their memories because the things they describe kind of push at the edges of consensus reality. And that felt like a really interesting space to play in as a novelist.
I'm so glad you brought that up about memory, because I wanted to talk about that. Memory, storytelling, and truth. So much of this story relies on what Alex and Anna remember or don't remember from their disappearance. I found myself thinking about what I remember from being young, and it's very blurry. It's maybe just bits and pieces of people and things. How did you work this into the story? How did you work memory and truth in pushing the story forward?
Yeah, I mean, something that I remember learning that really sort of unlocked the story for me was this concept of childhood amnesia, that there is this kind of universal neurological reset that people go through when they're about five, where it becomes incredibly difficult to remember really anything aside from a few little blurry bits from before that age. And that idea that there's a kind of built-in like lacuna in all of our minds, that there's this space that none of us can go, was so interesting to me, and felt like such a powerful engine for a story, because I don't want your, you know, your listeners to think that we don't get some kind of answer or resolution for what happened to Alex and Anna. We do. And I hope it feels, you know, surprising and alien and like something that rejects kind of everything that they could have conceived. But at the same time, I really wanted to think about the engine of irresolvability, sort of what it would mean for two people to not share their memories of this key event in their lives, and how the kind of way that that event might have knit them together, that the ways their memories start to fray could ultimately tear them apart. And I think that, you know, all relationships have origin stories, friendships included. And I wanted to think about what might happen if that origin story got poked and prodded and tested. Would it shake the foundations of this friendship? And would they be able to rebuild if it was kind of destroyed?
This is what we're reading on KAXE. We're talking with writer Meg Charlton about her new debut novel, Voyagers. I think we would be remiss to not talk about the extraterrestrial, the alien aspects of your story. It feels like we're at a moment in time where we've got Project Hail Mary, the movie coming out and being wildly successful. We've got, the timing of this is crazy, Disclosure Day, the movie, the Spielberg movie, just came out this weekend. Saw some similarities in what I know of the plot for that story with your book. So I'm just like, wow, this is all kind of converging. So it seems like there's this interest, and I don't feel like it ever has gone away, the interest in extraterrestrial life, but it feels like right now it's heightening. Artemis 2 mission around the moon. So what do you think our ongoing fascination about space says about us, and including your book too?
Yeah, I mean, the timing really is kind of eerie with you know, sort of lining up with the release of Disclosure Day and Artemis and Project Hail Mary. And there's another UFO book that just came out a few weeks ago that I'm really excited to read called Take Me With You. And I think that the thing about aliens, at least, that drew me in was kind of that existential question of, are we alone? And I think something Disclosure Day talks about that I was really interested to see was this question of faith and of what it would do to kind of our belief about our place in the universe if we discovered that there was other intelligent life. And it made me think about Jimmy Carter, who, you know, sort of sits at an interesting intersection in that he was this incredibly devout Christian, but he also, you know, sent out the Voyager missions, that he also saw a UFO allegedly when he, you know, back in 1969. And something really moving about that Jimmy Carter experience is that actually he gave an off-the-record interview or off-the-record conversation to NPR later, when one of your reporters asked about his UFO sighting, which he actually reported to a UFO group. And they asked if they found intelligent life in the universe, if it would sort of shake his belief in God. And he said, no, because, and this quote really moved me, like, God's hands are big enough for both of us. And I think there is in aliens and in UFOs this interesting confluence of both this conspiratorial thinking, which is kind of, you know, beginning to wear away and eat away at a lot of trust in our society, and also this incredible amount of kind of optimism and wonder and awe and hope that I think aliens are in many ways, you know, a belief that there is someone out there, that there is someone watching, that there is someone that we can join, you know, as they put it in that Voyager letter that was sent out, you know, some sort of society of intergalactic civilizations. And I think that so much of the allure of UFOs is about wanting to recognize and sort of see Earth from the outside. At least that is for me, to sort of see it the way the Artemis crew saw it, see it the way the Earthrise photo saw it, sort of recognize that we are, you know, this dust mote suspended in a sunbeam, this little pale blue dot, and to kind of see ourselves the way that an alien might, and to see our specialness, even as we would recognize that we aren't unique and we aren't alone. So I think that there's this kind of interesting, tension between both this desire for a story that makes sense about the world, this sort of conspiratorial thinking, and then a conspiracy or a belief that would kind of open the world up and make it bigger and stranger than we ever expected.
So did you read a lot of science fiction books growing up? What kind of books were you reading?
I did. I read pretty voraciously. I was the kid who read the dictionary. I was a big reader. But science fiction was very important in our house. You know, we used to joke that like all answers in life could be or all questions in life could be answered in Star Trek. And, you know, I had like a Star Wars Trivial Pursuit and, you know, watched Contact, which was a huge influence on my novel, you know, dozens of times. So I think something that was really foundational for me was also not just loving science fiction, but loving science. I loved going to the planetarium. I loved space and I loved nature. And I really think that a lot of my, you know, sort of work as a science fiction writer came from wanting to describe the world the way that I saw it, which was as a place full of, you know, strange, fascinating, invisible signals.
I noticed on your website you have a Voyager's music playlist linked there, and I took a look at it. Tell us about the songs that are on this list and what they mean to you and the story.
So everyone can go check out the playlist. Some of them were songs that I listened to while I was writing a lot. Sun Ra was an artist who, for obvious reasons, I listened to a lot while I was writing, and he's number one on the list. And then some of them were songs that appear in the book, It's All Coming Back to Me Now by Celine Dion, you know, makes an appearance in the novel. And so much of it was about, you know, whenever I work on a project, I like to have a playlist to kind of drop me back into the mood of the book. That writing a book takes years and years, and you need to find some toe line back into the emotional truth of the story. And music has always been an easy way and such a pleasurable way to find my way back into kind of the heart of what it is that I'm writing about.
Meg Charlton is the author of Voyagers. It's What We're Reading. I'm Tammy Bobrowski.
What We're Reading is made possible in part by the Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota. You can share what you're reading over on our What We're Reading Facebook page or text us 218-326-1234. I'm currently reading, and I'm very late to the party on this book, but The Late Homecomer by Cao Kalia Yang, who is a Hmong writer living in the Twin Cities. And Tammy's talked to her before. She just recently had a children's book come out, but this book came out in about 2008, and it's about her experience of being born in a refugee camp in Thailand and then moving to America when she was about 6 years old. So that's what I'm reading right now.
Yeah. The talk during what we're reading about, you know, Jimmy Carter's belief in God and if that would be shaken by the knowledge of extraterrestrial life, and brought to mind about last year I was quote unquote reading through in the form of audiobook series of books, you know, The Speaker for the Dead, which is kind of a sequel to the first book. The title's escaping my mind right now, but it has a scenario of being on an alien planet with the alien life form, and it tackles a few issues with religion and extraterrestrial life, namely, you know, what would we do with our religion on that planet? Would we be proselytizing and, you know, evangelizing and things like that? And you know, how does that work as far as, you know, your religious beliefs? And it's an interesting, you know, thought experiment. So
right. Well, we will have